This is Sophia Pinedo Paddock reading from Michael Chabon's Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, pages 602 to 604. The thought was banal, and yet somehow, as happened every now and then, it took him by surprise and profoundly disappointed him. It was absurd, but underlying his experience of the world, at some deep Precambrian stratum, was the expectation that someday, but when, he would return to the earliest chapters of his life. It was all there, somewhere, waiting for him. He would return to the scenes of his childhood, to the breakfast table of the apartment off the Graben, to the oriental splendor of the locker room at the Militarund Civil Schwimmschule, not as a tourist to their ruins, but in fact, not by means of some enchantment, but simply as a matter of course. This conviction was not something rational or even seriously believed, but somehow it was there, like some early fundamental error in his understanding of geography. That, for instance, Quebec lay to the west of Ontario, which no amount of subsequent correction or experience could ever fully erase. He realized now that this kind of hopeless but ineradicable conviction lay at the heart of his inability to let go of the money that he had banked all those years ago in the East Side Stagecrafts Credit Union. Somewhere in his heart, or wherever it was that such errors are cherished and fed, he believed that someone, his mother, his grandfather, Bernard Kornblum, might still, in spite of everything, turn up. Such things happened all the time. Those reported shot in the Lotz ghetto or carried off by typhus at the Zehlendorf DP camp, turned up owning grocery stores in Sao Paulo, or knocking on the front door of a brother-in-law in Detroit looking for a handout. Older, frailer, altered beyond recognition, or disarmingly unchanged, but alive. He went back into the house, tied his necktie, put on a jacket, and took the car keys from their hook in the kitchen. He was not sure where he was going to go, not at first, but the smell of the sea lingered in his nose, and he had a vague notion of taking the car and driving down to Fire Island for an hour, returning before anybody even knew that he was gone. The idea of driving excited him, too. From the moment he saw it, Sammy and Rose's car had aroused his interest. The Navy had taught Joe to drive, and he had taken to it with his usual aplomb. His happiest moments during the war had been three brief trips he had made behind the wheel of a jeep at Guantanamo Bay. That was a dozen years ago. He hoped he had not forgotten how. He found his way out onto Route 24 without any problem, but somehow or other he missed the turn to East Islip, and before he quite recognized it, he was on his way into the city. The car smelled of Rose's lipstick and Sammy's hair cream and a salt and wool residue of winter. There was almost no one on the road for a long time, and when he encountered other travelers, he felt a mild sense of pleasant kinship with them as they followed the light of their headlights into the western darkness. On the radio, Rosemary Clooney was singing "Hey There," and then, when he gave the dial a spin, she was there again, singing "This Old House." He rolled down the window, and sometimes there was a sound of grasses and night bugs, and sometimes the lowing of a train. Joe loosened his grip on the wheel and lost himself in the string sections of the hit songs and the rumble of the Champion's straight eight. After a while, he realized that a fair amount of time had gone by without his having thought of anything at all, least of all about what exactly he was going to do when he reached New York. Approaching the Williamsburg Bridge, not really certain of how he had managed to find himself there, he experienced an extraordinary moment of buoyancy, of grace. There was a lot more traffic now, but his shifting was smooth, and the sturdy little car was adroit at changing lanes. He launched himself out over the East River. He could feel the bridge humming underneath his wheels, and all around him could sense the engineering of it, the forces and tensions and rivets that were all conspiring to keep him aloft. To the south, he glimpsed the Manhattan Bridge, with its Parisian air, refined, elegant, its skirts hiked to reveal tapered steel legs, and beyond, the Brooklyn Bridge, like a great ropey strand of muscle. In the other direction lay the Queensboro Bridge, like two great iron serenas linking hands to dance. And before him, the city that had sheltered him and swallowed him and made him a modest fortune loomed, gray and brown, festooned with swags and boas of some misty gray stuff, a compound of harbor fog and spring dew, and its own steamy exhalations. Hope had been his enemy, a frailty that he must at all costs master, for so long now that it was a moment before he was willing to concede that he had let it back into his heart.